Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 3rd, 2006. Our session today is entitled Reflecting on the Death Penalty. Who are these people? Why do they do these things? Our presenter is Ingrid Christensen. Session number CHI 2006-4. Let's listen in.
Welcome. I'm Ingrid Christensen. I'm from Chicago, and I am going to be teaching tonight in the area of the death penalty, where it's the first of four sessions, and I thought tonight I would just tell stories about people. So you kind of have a sense of who these people are that are facing the death penalty, and maybe why they do, some of them do some of these things. I'd like to acknowledge at the start that murder is a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing that we have murder victims. We all probably know of murder victims in our own areas, and it's incomprehensibly evil and bad. And I don't want to go right from there to pointing to the defendants and say that they are evil, but I think that is something we'll have to consider this week. So I spent a lot of time being trained in victim outreach, which means that I spend some time with the families of murder victims. And I've learned a tremendous amount on that path. I have much more to learn. But my primary job is doing what we call the mitigation of people who are facing the death penalty. And mitigation is, in the court of law, a death penalty case, a trial, will have several parts. One part is pretrial motions, where there are various issues of law that are sorted out by the court before the trial begins. Then there's the guilt and innocence phase of a trial, where the evidence is brought and the facts of the case are discussed, and where the jury decides, and it's always a jury in the case of a death case, the jury decides guilt or innocent. Guilty or innocence. And then there's a very short little interim piece, like the middle of January term, sort of a little
piece.
Yes. Where the jury decides, is this defendant, if he's found guilty, if or she's been found guilty, is this person a candidate legally for the death penalty? In other words, does it meet the criteria of death? In Illinois, there are other rules in other states, but in Illinois, we have the death. You can only get the death penalty if you commit at least one murder plus any one of a list of 21 other things. So there are 21 other things that can exacerbate the murder to the point that you are a candidate for death. It could be a second murder. It could be murdering somebody under, 10 or 12, or over 65. So if you get murdered in over 65, you are automatically making your assailant a candidate for death penalty in Illinois. If you murder in the course of another crime, which is a felony, if you murder as part of a gang activity, so there are 21 of these things. The feds have a different list. They have 47 on their list. And then other states. There are 38 states that have the death penalty. And in the balance of the states, there's no state death penalty, but the federal government can bring a death case in any one of those states. I know some of you in the room are experts in this area. Some of you have dealt in the criminal justice system in various official capacities, and I welcome your input. But today it's going to be tough because I'm going to do a lot of storytelling. I just didn't finish. We have our January term, and then we have our spring semester. The spring semester in our capital case is a whole other trial, but in front of the same jury, or at the defendant's election, it can be just in front of the judge at that point. The jury can be dismissed. Where we do the sentencing or the penalty phase of a trial. In the penalty phase of a trial, the prosecution puts on the aggravation. The aggravation is all the dreadful facts of the crime. Mm-hmm. It's photographs of the crime scene. It's relatives of the dead person or people who come in and talk about their pain and grief and how this has impacted their life. There are legal limits to how much they can say, but it's invariably a very moving and sad experience. And then the defense puts on mitigation, and that's where I come in. The mitigating factors or the mitigating circumstances of a client's life or a defendant's life are of three sorts in general. There's a, you want to know the whole chronology of the person's life. So from the beginning to the end, you want to know what their life has consisted of from before the beginning. In other words, you want to get their mother's pregnancy records. And if the mother has a history of mental illness or disease, you want to get those records, even before conception. And if there's mental illness or disease in the prior generations, you want to get those records. And then you come down to this person's life, and you get all of the records of their life, educational records, medical records, institutional records of other sorts, like if they've been incarcerated or if they've been in the military. And then you interview, I generally interview about 100 people. I start with the mom, go to the dad, and interview the brothers and sisters, but sometimes, of course, they don't cooperate, so you might not have success in that whole immediate family. Aunts and uncles, cousins, teachers, childhood friends, street friends or acquaintances, depending on their lifestyle, girlfriends, children, wives and ex-wives. You want to find out whatever you can find out about their pastor, if they have one, an old pastor, someone who was close to the family. You want to find out what you can, and most of your goal is to get them to tell you the family secrets. So you're a snoop, a gossip, you know, and almost not gossip, but a snoop. But it's extremely important to find out these things about the person, and often the family is very vested in keeping secrets. They don't want these things to get out, because of course all our families have secrets, and we don't want them out. So I do that, I talk to all those people. I do some discerning about the client himself or herself, trying to decide if there's a mystery about how it came to the place where this crime was committed. I just don't get it. I sit hours in the basement of Cook County Jail or in some other jail with this person. I can't figure out, why did you do this crime? Why? I have such a person now, and I will tell you about her. And she, for over a year, said to me, I don't know. It took her a long time to figure it out. And then I try to find three kinds of things. I try to find everything good the person has ever done in their life with all these interviews and documents and stuff that I've gathered. What good things have they done in their life? Have they done anything good? You know, there are people who will claim to me, I've never done a good thing. Jim Hart was one of them. He just said, I've never done a good thing. It turns out he was wrong. But, you know, some people have had a pretty barren life. I want to know the bad things that have happened to them. And those, of course, are everything from sexual abuse and other kinds of abuse as children to calamities. All sorts of bad things happen to people. We know about that. And then the third thing I do is try to figure out if there are medical concerns. So if there are mental things or things that a doctor can diagnose. And then when I get, I'm not a pro in that area, but I sort of get a sense of it. You know, this person seems goofy in this way or that. Or then I hire doctors to come and do work on this person to try to figure them out. So I get to know a lot about their lives. So I figured, who are these people? I always promise my clients that if all fails, if they're found guilty, if they're given the death penalty, if all of their appeals are denied and they are in fact going to go to their execution, I promise that if they want me to come, I'll come. So there are two things about that. I mean, obviously, I hope it never happens. It hasn't happened. But I figure it's my job to try not to have that happen, it's like I have to put my life on, I have to put my money where my mouth is or something. I want, if they are executed, I want them to know that someone there who's looking at them knows their passage here on the earth, that they know everything about them. They know what their life has been. They don't pass unrecognized in this place. But I also tell them, I have to talk to you about your spirituality, because how can I accompany you in death if I don't know what to think is happening when you die? So we do talk a lot about their faith, and we sing hymns, truth be told, and we pray, and all those things in these secular institutions. But I do know a lot about them for that reason. Why they do these things, I generally come to an understanding of why I think they do these things, but we can talk about that tonight. So let me tell you, let me just ask you a question. Suppose it was reported in the paper that someone had been arrested for shooting, some drug dealer had been arrested for shooting another drug dealer, and this was a person who had a juvenile record of incarceration. He was at the time of the shooting 20. And he had also been convicted of a murder when he was 11. What kind of a person would you think he was? What images pop into your mind?
Well, he'd be like one of my students. Yeah, I have students that would do this. I know their backgrounds.
He's a psychopath, mm-hmm. A sociopath.
Yeah, you think something like that. That's a good one.
I wouldn't.
You wouldn't?
No. No, I would just think that that was a way of life that they had learned. They weren't necessarily sociopaths, but they had, that was their means of survival on the streets.
Okay, so we have two different points of view. Jeannie?
Oh, I was just going to say, I don't know about the drug dealer killing others, but the 11-year-old killing, it sounds like an angry young child. Uh-huh. He's angry about something.
Okay, so can I tell you the story of the person who was convicted of this series of events? He was called Parrish. He was an only child of a drug-addicted street mom and an alcoholic street dad who were not married. His mom was from a big family, five people, and the grandmother, who was his favorite person on the planet, ran this enormous drug and prostitution house on the west side of Chicago. So when he was born into this family, the grandmother was an enormous woman, 450 pounds, and she sat on a bed all day up in her room and drank bourbon. She ran this house with five bedrooms. Each of her children got a bedroom to make money out of, and they each were assigned a different drug. So they had, somebody was selling crack and somebody was selling whatever, each different thing. And then the basement was where the prostitution happened. So the children, when they were young, were forbidden to go down the basement because there was always business going on down there. But this was his family, and they were close. He was loved, which actually has made an enormous difference in his life. His mother was pretty much a druggie, and she wasn't much, but aunts and uncles and cousins were around. When he was 11, a cousin killed someone. And the cousin was 15 or something. And in their family, there's a culture that says, when an older child kills someone, someone under 12 has to take the rap. Because the one under 12 will only get 4 or 5 years, probably 5 years in prison. And the older one might get 40. So his cousin did a murder, he took the rap. He went because he took the rap. He was sent to a juvenile institution in Utah because he went out, the 11-year-old murderer was shocking. No one would spend money and try to help his kid. So he went to a facility in Utah that had cottages. And when he was put into his cottage with 6 other kids or whatever, and house parents, they thought he was retarded, and they thought he was physically somehow something wrong with him because he was kind of a lumpy, unpromising, bad kid, and couldn't read, and he just was shut down. But they made him go to school every day, and they made him do his homework for a specified period of time every day, which was supervised. They made him eat 3 squares. When he got sick, they took care of him. When he was well, he was made to go on forced marches, as we used to call it, when our children had to go hiking up the dance and hold our children not voluntarily hike like maniacs, but when they were kids, they were horse marches. So this kid was made to, you know, play football and soccer and hike in the mountains of Utah. In the 4 years he was there, he became the head of his class. He's not only did he learn to read, he got to be a very good student. He was a leader. He became so responsible that they let him leave campus and go into town, and he was a detail man at the local Chevrolet shop. So he was thriving and doing so well that the state of Illinois would have paid for his mom to come once every 6 months to visit her son in Utah. And she came once, but because she's a drug addict, she didn't get it together. She intended to come. She certainly intended to come, but she didn't get it together to come. So, but then his parole agent in Chicago and his mother would get on the phone with the staff at the institution in Utah. And I read a bunch of his documents about his hopes that last year he was there, all the things he intended to become, because he found out what a good student he was, and that he was a leader, and that he could do all these things, and he was really fired up. His mother said, I will get a new apartment. I'm getting a new apartment in Oak Park, which is a suburb to the west of Chicago. And he's not going to be involved in the gangs that the rest of your family is in and all the rest of in our neighborhood. His grandmother's house, where she sat up there on the third floor in her bed, all 400 pounds of her, whatever it was, burned down, and she with it. So the grandmother was gone. House was gone. So when he reached the end of his time in Utah, with much love from all those institutional, decent, hardworking caregivers in Utah, he came back to Chicago. He landed at O'Hare, where he had never been before, except when he was shipped out. When he left the community, remember, he was 11. He had never used the public transportation system. He didn't know anything about any community except Austin, where he lived. He lands at O'Hare, and nobody meets his plane. So here he is at O'Hare. He's a lost kid. He doesn't know what to do. Nobody's got his plane. He doesn't know where his mom lives or his dad lives, because they've both moved several times since he was in the community. So he finds his way back to Austin somehow. I don't know how. He walks or something. He gets back there, and he kind of wanders the streets of his old neighborhood until he finds an old school chum selling drugs on a corner. And the school chum says, "You can sleep on my floor." So he moves into that kid's floor. And pretty soon, within 2 weeks, he's got his own corner for selling drugs. All he had to take was one more course. He had to take Illinois history to graduate. So he was excited. He was going to take Illinois history. He was going to graduate. Well, you know. So because he turned out to be smart and capable, he became a drug organizer and a drug dealer. And he, in fact, did shoot somebody when he was 20. And because he had a second murder on his record, he was a candidate for the death penalty, and that's when I got him. So I was so mad. I was so frustrated when I figured out this story. I went to his parole agent, the person who had been his parole agent at that time, and said, "Where were you? Why didn't you go to O'Hare?" And he said, "Oh, I don't know. I guess I just lost track." And I said to his mother, "Why didn't you go to O'Hare?" "Oh, you know, a lot of help she is." So I thought about all the institutions that Parrish had gone to, some of which had really come through for him, but some of which failed, and the failures were just at the wrong times. And so now he's spending the rest of his life in prison. He's, during the 2 years, or 3 years, how many years? 16, 24 years, he was in the community before he was locked up. He fathered 2 children. So he constantly writes me letters from the prison in Illinois asking for more stationery, because the prison, you can get these sort of pieces of drab newsprint yellow to write home on, but he writes to his children on brightly colored stationery, because I taught him the word stationery. None of my clients, I have 25 clients in the years I've been doing this work, none of them have ever heard of stationery. None of them. So stationery is something I introduce into all of their lives, because keeping, you know, writing letters, keeping contact with your family, writing to the children. But Parrish writes to his kids, and he's always writing me and saying, how can I better father a 5-year-old? He's a dear man, but
how old is he now?
I got him when he was 20, so he's 24. So that's one story of one person. You know, the things here that entered into that for him, poverty was certainly part of it. Although they had enough money through all their drug deals and prostitution and stuff. Right down the street, half a block away from that house that burned down, was the police station. And you can't tell me that those local cops didn't know about that house. They didn't know that there were small children being raised in it. Mental illness was not really a factor there, and I think the reason is that he was loved. I really think that being loved. He had major depression. When he was in Utah, they started treating his depression. I mean, he's still antidepressants. Drugs and alcohol, well, that was the deal. He didn't do drugs and alcohol himself, but the family. Drugs and alcohol entered the picture somewhere, almost always. In this case, it was all the people around him. Child abuse, I would call that child abuse, being raised in a family like that. Social relationships in his case were reasonably intact, just weird. You know, if everybody had their own drug business or sex business in this house, that's weird. And bad moms. In this bad moms thing, I have to say that I hate having bad moms on the list of things that I think are reasons why people do this thing. But I'm a feminist, you know, I really want to support women. But I just think, in all but one of my cases, the moms involved have not been neutral. They haven't been just sort of neglectful. They haven't been uninspired. They have been bad moms. Mean, cruel, bizarre, crazy, bad. So I think bad moms, it's, you know, sometimes dads, but. So that's one client. How about Eric? I don't remember what Eric did. He gets sort of inured to this, you know, you see the photographs of the crimes and you know how awful it is, and then you just concentrate on your quiet and kind of turn away from this. Eric was arrested for rape. He did a variety of minor sexual offenses when he was a teenager, and then he was arrested for rape and sent off to prison for 15 years. And he came back, and when he was sent away, he came back and murdered somebody when he was 30. So, or 31, he'd been back for 14 months when this happened. So what would you say about that? What kind of a person would do that? He was institutionalized for 15 years in a correctional institution. He comes back 14 months later, he does another terrible crime, a worse crime. Mm-hmm. So then the way that's talked about in the news and by the prosecutors is that he's on, wouldn't you say he's on a trajectory, he's getting worse and worse, and you know, he's the dregs of society. When he went away, well, let me tell you about his childhood. He was one of two sons in a family of a married couple. Well, at first, when his dad was married to his mom, his dad was married to another woman also, but that eventually got cleared up, and there were some divorces and remarriages. But the dad was a pimp, and the mom was sort of a party girl. But she, some of you know about this. I read a poem about her the other day, Ruth. So she was a party girl. Bars, mostly. The dad was a pimp, and he took his son out. He took him on his first heist, jewelry store heist, when he was 9. He had the kid hold the bag. Well, he's, got them. They weren't caught. He did film pornography in the mother had fixed up a nice bedroom for her two sons. And it was fixed up so nicely, you know, a little frou-frou and whatever, that the dad started making pornographic films in there with various women that he brought home. This bedroom, I suppose, was nice. I don't know, it was... Or maybe he thought that the little boy cuteness of it made it more tilly to have pornographic films in there. I don't know. Eventually, the mother gave up and turned the kid over to the state when he was 12 and said, I can't handle him anymore. And the state immediately gave him to his father, who was a well-known pimp and a drug addict. And the father took the kid to live in a house with no electricity or running water, an ex-house, a house that was formerly a house. No. And they lived there for a while. And then finally they moved into the Lawson Y, which is a Y in Chicago, which is well known for a center for homosexual activity. And it's a cheap place to live. But nobody under 18 is allowed to live in the Lawson Y, so the father had to pay off somebody at the desk to let the kid kind of sneak into the dad's room every night or whenever. And because it was illegal for Eric to be there, the father didn't request a second mattress, so the kid slept on the floor. And that went on for about a year. The Lawson Y, besides being a center for homosexual activity in Chicago, is also a place very close to the Gold Coast, so there's a lot of wealth. And so, of course, the dad, who was this hustler and opportunist, was out teaching the kid to steal from the wealthy, because there would be people with money there, up and down Michigan Avenue. So there was a lot of that kind of thing that went on. And the dad brought he had a girlfriend, a former girlfriend who was 27 at the time, that he brought home and gave to his son, who was at the time 14. And he brought prostitutes home, and they had three ways. They shared sex in this room, the Lawson Y. So the dad was a very hypersexualized guy. He was dressed like a classic pimp all the time. All the photographs of him are, you know, all pimped out in his fancy pimp clothes. And there's a photograph of the dad with a kid, where the kid is kind of like, both parents are dead, so I had to rely on photographs. Well, when the kid is 15, he breaks into an apartment of a wealthy white girl in the neighborhood, and he's black, and he rapes her. He breaks in to steal, he says, but he rapes this girl. Worst nightmare. Here you are, young, just out of college, white girl, sound asleep in your apartment, and some black kid breaks in the middle of the night and rapes you. And he shook bars in her windows, he cried about her. And then he went out to prison for 15 years, and he came home. But before he went out to prison, he had one girlfriend. He had a proper girlfriend that was sweet, and they had a very sweet, and I have lots of photographs, and they went to a school dance together, and they were sort of a sweet couple. She was from this neighborhood. Because he moved around so much with dad that he didn't have a steady relationship with her, but he idealized her. And he thought when he got out of prison, he would come back and they would get married. And while he was in prison, she wrote to him and said, I love you. He got back, and she was married and had four children. And he eventually murdered her husband. So then I died. I don't know, should we execute him? No, it's just, he's pathetic. He's completely pathetic.
What was the aggravating factor?
Breaking and entering, I guess. Middle of the night, he broke into the house. The father was sleeping in a bed with an 8-year-old, and he rounded up all the knives in the kitchen. The mother was sleeping on the couch with a newborn or an infant. Two other kids were sleeping in another room, and the father was sleeping in a bed with the 8-year-old, and Eric went and got the knives all and hid them under something and took one knife and went into the bedroom and stabbed the dad in front of the 8-year-old, who was asleep but woke up, of course. So it was a dreadful scene, and the 8-year-old was traumatized. But he broke in, I think that's what it was. So, and then he walked away from the crime scene. But by then, the girl had wakened up. She was screaming at him, "Eric, Eric, don't do this thing." He ran away, and 10 minutes later, the cops were there. He came back, covered in the victim's blood, and turned around and went like this and said, "I'm the guy you're looking for." So he completely, you know, and he regret. He turned to his would-be girlfriend, his beloved. I have all the poetry he wrote about her in the 15 years he was locked up. During those 15 years, he was obsessing about her, of course, and remembering all these beautiful things about her. He turned to her and he said, "I'm so sorry." And then on his videoed statement, he said, you know, they took him to the police station and he immediately made a videoed statement. He was still bloody. And he said, "I've done a terrible thing. I'm so sorry. I have deprived those four children of a father for the rest of their lives. I've deprived the girl of a husband. I'm so sorry." But we knew that he was going to be executed because he had a judge that did executions. Much more, I mean, in the building at Cook County, there's a lot of judges. And there's some that do, some that don't, some that do occasionally. He was one that did a lot. With that same judge's daughter had been raped. So Eric had been raped. And he was on a trajectory. You know, there was this sense of trajectory that he was doing one bad thing, you know. So he eventually took a plea. Yeah.
Question, do you mean that he was tried to the bench?
No. No, he would have had a jury trial, but we would have. We can, you know, we would always consider whether we could have a bench sentencing and we couldn't turn to the judge for a second.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't have asked for a different judge at the beginning?
I don't know whether they did that or not. It's pretty tough in the building to get a different judge. But. So it's, he's pathetic. It's a sad case. It's a pathetic case. I don't know if it's a death penalty. Okay, let's say about this. He certainly had poverty. He lived a lot of his life in hand-to-mouth situations with no certainty of having a toilet to flush. His mental evaluations were that he was extremely depressed and had very low self-esteem. They were not necessarily that he had a mental illness. He denied his drugs or alcohol. He was a victim of child abuse. Imagine sharing prostitutes with your 12-year-old. His social relationships were terrible. He didn't have social relationships. And he had a bad mom. She was a little more neglectful. She wasn't so bad, but she was. So that's Curtis. Let's take a woman for a story.
I guess I want to ask him anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
What was his prison experience after the rape?
He was rebellious in his teens and had a number of tickets. He acted out. They mostly had to do with things like we were supposed to walk next to the wall and he would walk out in the middle of the hallway, you know. Or
that's a teenager.
Yeah. But he also did one sexual assault in prison of another boy, and then that charge was dropped for reasons that we never were able to discern. There was some, whether it was consensual or whether the other boy went on to have other sexual partners. I don't know what it was, but he received a year's additional punishment for that, and then suddenly it was taken away. His time was restored. And then once he got into his 20s, from 20 to 30, he became a Muslim, and as many, many, many prisoners do, they convert to Islam while they're in prison. I couldn't figure it out for a long time why so many of my clients were Muslims. And then I started asking about it, and they say, because the imams, when they're in prison, are so respectful of them, and they teach them how to practice their faith.
And that's the leader, right?
It's like a pastor. And so I ask them what they mean by practicing their faith, and they say we pray five times a day, we pray together if we can, we keep ourselves clean, including scrubbing ourselves with a toothbrush. We keep our bodies clean, and we keep our clothes clean, and we read the Quran every day, and we do one good deed a day. So they knew what to do for their faith. And whereas the Christian pastors who would come in there were all sort of hellfire and brimstone, you're going to hell, we'll take shame on you. Yeah.
Yeah, I really wanted to say something sooner, and boy, this really brings it out. We talk about poverty, and all we think about is money and living these very meager rations and means and so on. But I think that we could really use the expression moral poverty, and having the imam, a good imam, come and build them up in character-wise to respect them and have them respect back. That's moral development. And they, in my opinion, the two you've talked about so far had none of that at a decent level when they were young.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So it, you can call
the first
it
one back. Went to church occasionally with a local storefront. The second one never. But boy, did that second one go for it! Once he started getting a taste of it, he wanted that discipline, religion, spirituality. When I got him, he said he was so ashamed of himself. He was in such despair and so ashamed of himself that he said, "I cannot pray. I cannot come into the presence of God, because I'm too sinful, too awful. I've done too terrible things." And so I worked with that. I did Old Testament Bible study, Bible stories. And finally, I just one day, we sat and bolted down chairs beside each other with a stainless steel counter in front of us with a glass wall right here. And on the other side of the glass wall, there was a guard. And that's where we met all the time. So then we were on our bolted down stools, and I reached over and grabbed his hand. On this day, something just made me do it. And I prayed. And I prayed that the Holy Spirit would come and blow through this place and bring grace and forgiveness to Eric. And help Eric get to the place where he could come into the presence of God. And he started to cry. And this was after living together for a year and a half. And he did. That was it. Things changed. We started doing more study together and also more praying together. And that's what enabled him to finally take a plea instead of go to trial and take the death penalty. Was because he finally started to forgive himself. And when he could do that and get to the point where he realized he was not the sum of the worst thing he'd ever done in his life, then he could think about a plea. Until then, he just wouldn't talk plea.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious about, I'm not like pro-death penalty generally in this case, but it also seems like, you know, this person had raped someone and sexually assaulted someone in prison, and it's such a screwed up sort of upbringing, especially in the sexuality department, that even if it was going to kill someone, you know, like, I mean, I don't think that I would be like, well, let's put him like right back on the streets, you know? So I'm just wondering, like, what are the other options? Are there any? Like, what would you, or in your opinion, like, what do we do with somebody who doesn't deserve a death penalty? Certainly, like, just being in prison is not necessarily going to help. I mean, how do we?
I guess I think in the present system, where there isn't enough money to do real rehabilitation, I would say that Eric should get what he got, which is he's going to be imprisoned for, I think he got 40 years. He got that full length. But he will not. The way the present law reads, he will never be a candidate to get out. I don't think he should be on the street. I've talked to people who do sexual evaluation of sex offenders who say that after age something, 65 or something, they can do an evaluation of somebody and say, this person is not going to reoffend with some certainty. But before whatever their age is, I know it's after 50, sort of horrified me. I'm 62. I'm going to be sexually active for a long time. It's me. that, you know, there are people who think they can predict whether you're going to be offended, but I don't think people who are likely to be offended should be released. I think they should be in humane institutions, but they should.
Well, I have a perspective. My dad was a judge, so he was a judge for a lot of murder cases, and like one of the cases, the guy, like my life is still in danger because of a guy who's in prison. If he gets out, he has always said he would come after my family. And so I'm not necessarily for the death penalty, but it is near nerve-wracking knowing there's somebody who would kill me when he gets out. And so even though Minnesota doesn't have a death penalty, I'm from Minnesota, but it is a little scary for people like me who have done nothing wrong, but because my name is the same as my dad's, it could be killed. And this guy comes up for parole all the time. And so far, my dad has been able to petition to keep him in. It's worked, but he'll be out in my lifetime. Certainly, he's threatened still. But well, so it's a different perspective.
Yeah.
And my
the
dad,
right sentence would be. So that's
I mean, if they can keep him in for life, and we felt all secure that that would happen. I mean, I personally would feel more comfortable if he was dead.
Yeah.
Because then I don't have to worry about this particular guy. But I will, you know, he won't be. Or if I was certain that the judicial system would keep him in, it would be better for it. But if there's other men, too, who are Alfonso Rodriguez, do you remember hearing about
him?
My dad was the one who gave him the sentence for the length that he could give him. And he said he should never get out because he had stabbed a girl, not killed her, but stabbed her and raped her. My dad put him away as long as he could stay in. But he got out and they said, well, he's 50, he won't reoffend. And he, of course, killed a 19-year-old girl. And so our judicial system doesn't always keep these people in. And so that's I have a different perspective because I'm from that kind of background. And
most often the alternative to death penalty is natural life. And, in the way
and that's
great.
Right.
Natural
life. It just doesn't seem to happen now.
Right.
And they get out for parole, and the parole boards don't always read they don't. So
I guess you're vigilant and go and testify at every parole hearing. And who wants to do that?
Who wants to do that? And we've already had to do that for this. Yeah. This guy, you know, the first guy who...
Was it Satry?
Satry, yeah. My last name is Satry. So when they did Rodriguez, like CNN came and wanted to interview my dad, he said no because he doesn't want his name out there. You know, it's a very distinctive name. But so I come from that perspective of the death penalty. Although I don't necessarily believe in it, I would feel a little better if some of them were dead, just for my safety. You know, my family rather than me. You know.
The third of the four sessions this week is going to be on our Christian faith, and I'm still struggling with how to present it. But you know, do we always think that a person can be redeemed? Is that there's some chance for God to act in a person's life? Is one of the questions about our faith?
Yeah,
I think.
Actually, the question is kind of from a different perspective, and that is, how do you maintain your stress level and sanity?
My husband claims I'm a really sick person.
And that's got to get to you all the time. You have to be a very special person to do that.
I think it's because I entered this work very late in life. I started doing it in 2000, and I had been a college professor for 31 years before then. College students will eat you alive with a great sense of entitlement. And my clients now are so grateful for any little bit of attention and help they can get. And for someone who seriously will sit down and really attend to them and listen to their story, is a great gift. So I get energy from my book. I feel very called and very blessed to be in my
book.
Yeah. The timeline of when he developed his Muslim faith, was that in the initial 15 years or was that in the sense?
It was when he was around 20 years old and stopped acting out in prison immediately when that happened.
So what was the fact? I mean, it seems like if he developed a faith and then he comes out of prison and he murders his girlfriend.
That was one of the reasons he couldn't pray, is he felt he really offended his faith.
But what was the trigger, besides being angry that his girlfriend got married? I mean, what was a trigger that says I'm going to go kill somebody if you had the most, you know, if you had the strong faith? What did he say? Why
he wasn't practicing his faith once he got out.
So during when he was in prison, he was, but once he got out,
There's some people that just do better in prison than they do mm-hmm. than me in prison.
Mm-hmm. And so is that your stance? I mean, we're talking about capital punishment, but we're not talking about freedom, or, you know, being out of prison.
Oh, no.
Right, okay.
No, there are a lot of people that I have for clients that I would never want on the street, yes. ever, ever, ever. Please, God.
I want to clarify.
But most of them don't get on the street.
But we should not forget that there are some who actually really are innocent, and with that wonderful right. thing about DNA that has helped some, we don't want
to... When I do public policy day after tomorrow, we will talk about the innocent and the problem with the innocent. Yeah. I have a little more time. I'd sort of like to tell you about Caroline. Would that be?
Yes.
She is 26 years old. She was 26 when she was committed her crime. Her crime was, she's a serial killer. She killed four people over in two-week increments. Yeah, 2 weeks apart, every 2 weeks. The first three were men. The fourth was a woman. The three men were all persons who were unknown to her, but she did it with her cousin, and two of them were known to her cousin, another woman. The first one was a perfect stranger. No, the first one was a former boyfriend of the cousin's. And the second one was a perfect stranger. And the third one was another friend of the cousin's. And the fourth one was my client's best girlfriend, best friend. Shot her in the face in a car. She was sitting in the front seat. She turned around. Her friend was in the back seat sorting out the hamburgers. They just bought at a drive-thru to hand them out to everybody, and she shot her right in the face. She had never even had a traffic ticket. She was 26 years old. And she had four adorable, wonderful children who I'm close to now. Her two daughters, all the other two children are straight-A students, bright, wonderful, and now getting those screwy because of the mom. And the other two of the little boys are, one of them was a newborn at the time of the crime. 6 weeks old when this started. And for the first year, I would say, of my time with her, I kept asking her, you know, and she would go, I don't know. I can't explain it. And every Tuesday, which was her visiting day, she would cry because her best friend didn't come to visit her. The best friend that she had shot. I mean, I'm never going to figure this one out. This is too. But of course, eventually, by going to the outer circles, not to her mom and her children and her immediate family, but to a wider circle of people, who told on the family, I started to learn the necessary stories. She has a sister who was kicked out of the house when she was 11 and is now, it took me a long time to find her, she's a prostitute on the streets of Gary and crack addict. I had to go, you know, nobody had any recent pictures of her, nobody had seen her for years. So I had to take my son, who's the painter here, who's very good at getting people to trust him. And we just had to nose around until we found out where she was. So she told me, you know, our mom doesn't like teenagers. She kicked me out when I was 11. But while I was there, her boyfriend was sexually raping me. And so then I found out Cal, my client, had been kicked out when she was 13. She'd been on the street since she was 13. She was 26 now. That's a lot of years on the street. So, you know, nobody had told me that for the longest time. And then, of course, her school records corroborate that because the school records started to disintegrate after she was 13. She was sort of adopted by one of the top leaders of the GDs, Gangster Disciples, a big street gang in Chicago, and became a manager for the GDs, because she was very bright. So she managed money and cocaine, you know, she sold stuff and two distributors, she would give it up. And then she lived with the enforcer for the GDs, who was the enforcer is the person who's the most violent, you know, is charged with killing people or disciplining people, shooting their kneecaps off or whatever they do. And he would torture people in front of my client. She said eventually when she began to recall this that, yeah, she recalled it because I found it out otherwise and brought it to her and said, well, what about this? And she said, oh, yeah. And I said, why did he do that? Why did he torture? Why did he? Like, there's one guy we have the court records on. He reamed out his behind with a broomstick. And the guy's on a colostomy now. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, Cal had been forced to witness. And then he badly beat up a woman in front of her two little girls. And my client was forced to witness that. And there were a series of things like that. So I've been traveling around to federal penitentiaries now interviewing GDs about this history because I need to get it from other points of view. So she lived with the enforcer for a big, mean, bad street gang. And she learned very early to keep a very low profile and behave herself and did what he said because of all this violence that he was capable of. And then she was so smart. She still is. She writes beautifully. She's so smart. She craves Shakespeare. I send her Shakespeare and then like a week away and I go to prison and talk to her and she can talk about Shakespeare. She just craves learning. She's like a sponge. And she's a Christian. So, but she, you know, is completely shattered in terms of her guilt, and it took her a long time to even understand that she had done these things. Her children, she's resigned herself to losing, and she talks to them weekly and writes them letters and sends them pictures and stuff, but she knows that her life is over. And she doesn't still really know why she did it, but she knows that when each of her four children were born, she became extremely depressed. And there's a large body of research that talks about how black women are ashamed of mental illness and will not ask for help. So I sort of tested that out on her, and sure enough, she said, well, I never tell anybody. I said, well, how did you act after your babies were born? And she said, well, I just locked myself in the bathroom and cried for periods of time. Like, and I did it all every 3 hours. I think, okay. And I learned this from her daughters. Her daughters would tell me, well, after the baby was born, we would stand outside the bathroom door and yell, Mom, Mom, are you okay? And she'd be crying there for long periods, day after day. So she had postpartum depression, which turned into a psychosis. And now, of course, we've gotten verified with psychological help. So evidently, that's what it is. It's this whole set of buried experiences, having been molested at home by her mother's boyfriend and then being in the care of the street gang until they were all busted. The whole leadership of the street gang were busted in one day. I forget what year, but LeMain 21 or whatever, the whole leadership of the GDs, Larry Hoover et al. And at that point, my client was pregnant with her first child. She had great income, great support, and activity. So, you know, managing this business. And a secure home, a nice home, because there was a lot of money that flowed through this GD business. And, you know, it had its downsides, but at least she had security. And then she finally got pregnant with her first child, and then just then, they were busted. So she lost her job, her home, her boyfriend, her security, was back on the streets, pregnant. And then she hooked up with a variety of inappropriate men, and they hurt her, and you know, bad things. It went from bad to worse. She was living in homeless shelters, many different homeless shelters. So in a way, our public policy of busting all these GDs, she was collateral damage for a big bust of a huge street gang. A federal, you know, bust that had been going on for several years. So that's where she is now. She's still in the place of being so shattered and sorrowful that she can't really hold her head up. she's writing a lot, so I'm hopeful that we're going to help.
Is she in, been there for life, or is she on a death row, or what?
She hasn't been tried yet.
She hasn't been tried yet.
What would you like to see for her?
Well, of course, I'd like mental illness treatment and hospitalization and things like that, and then a long period of reconstruction and detention. Mm-hmm. I have told her I don't want you out in the streets. Mm-hmm. And she's finally come to accept that. But she'll just be warehoused somewhere. She doesn't get the death penalty. Because she's a serial killer, the likelihood of her getting the death penalty is pretty high.
That's pretty rare, isn't it, for a female to be a serial killer?
Yeah. She's also physically beautiful. I don't know if that makes any difference. But... So that's another story. I tell you these stories because I think it's important for us to see into the hearts as much as we can of people before we make judgments about them and before we decide to cast them away on the scrap heap. So on tomorrow's the 4th of July, we won't do this, but on Wednesday we'll talk some more about the public policy issues. Thursday we'll do some issues about our faith and the death penalty. And Friday, more about policy and action, possible action. And some of you will be roped in, at least one of you has already been roped in, but possibly talking on those days. So I want to say that community, well-developed, good community, would address a lot of these issues, and a lot of these people would not be there if they were in good social structure. And so I recommend Jody Kretzmann's classes to you, because that's about building social structure that would make healthy societies in a way that would not produce killers. And on that note, I want to thank you for coming. Yes.
Could you tell us one thing? Where will you be meeting on Wednesday? Will it be in here?
I don't remember.
It's on there.
But it's on the
fireside. Fireside.
Oh, okay, thank you. I can't see that from here.
It'll be on the kiosk.
3:30, fireside.
Okay, thank you.
Thursday, the faith one is here in the evening at 6:30. And Friday, 4:45,
fireside.
That's
my
one last question. We have time for one more question.